And go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, potentially good news on the UAW front, as the UAW and the GM negotiators have come to evidently a tentative agreement. We'll find out more as the days pass. Potentially could end tomorrow, getting people back to work soon after that. We're also finding out tomorrow, big day in Chicago. The Chicago teachers could be walking out and going on strike. The school district, the CPS has canceled classes for tomorrow, anticipating this strike. And here to share some thoughts on the strike potential in Chicago, I've asked Michelle Gunderson to come talk with us. Michelle's a Chicago public school teacher, also a trustee with the teachers union there in Chicago. Michelle, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Good to be on your show again. Thank you so much.
Good to hear from you again. It seems like every time you're on, there's something going on, though.
Well, that's what we are. We're the Chicago Teachers Union, and we make things happen. Hey, strike is on. We had a House of Delegates meeting tonight. We are a very democratic union, and we went over the open items in our contract and the Chicago Public Schools offer to us, and it was unanimous. There are 800 people in our House of Delegates. Strike is on. Tomorrow morning, there'll be people on the picket starting at 6:30 in the morning at their schools.
And what's that issue here? I mean, you know, we saw at GM the issue was, you know, the five-tier wage system, a lot of, you know, job-related stuff. What are the conditions here?
You know, Rick, it's equity. It's just that our schools have deteriorated to the point where people can't do their work. And there's an Illinois state law that only gives us permissible subjects to strike on, pay and benefits and time. And so we are not happy with the pay offer. That's absolutely true. They've left the lowest paid workers in our building in the dust once again. But also, we have an unequal system in Chicago. There are schools that don't have librarians or nurses or social workers, the things that make doing the work possible.
Right.
And so it's a very broad fight. But what we know is that it's a 90% black and brown school student population that's not getting schools that make it even possible to learn.
That's not unique to Chicago. I mean, that's virtually every major city in this country that has that kind of, you know, where the poverty, the schools that are in poverty tend to have no resources. I mean, I look at Philadelphia on some of the horror stories that we've seen over the years coming out of there, where they don't have nurses or librarians, asbestos in buildings. And you could just go down the list of all of the tragic conditions that are there. I'm sure you're seeing the same things.
Right. And so it's such a good question, what's at stake? And it's the learning of children. The loss of potential is something we can't measure. And when we have 40 children in a kindergarten classroom, that child might be able to go to school. That child, because they're lovely and wanting to learn, will learn something. But I don't think we can ever think about the loss of potential of a child being in an overcrowded classroom.
40 kids in a kindergarten class? I mean, that doesn't even sound like there's enough room to trip over each other.
Well, I teach first grade, and it's impossible to teach a large class size and give the children the attention that they need. So class size is not a permissible, strikeable subject matter.
You think it should be, though?
Well, you know what? We're the Chicago Teachers Union, and we know that we might not be able to strike about it legally, but we will be able to fight about it. And I think we've made our case in the public. One of the things that you've brought up, that this is the plight of urban school systems countrywide, is that there are no good old days to go back to, and there are no other school systems of large populations like ours to look to for guidance. So we've teamed up as unionists around the country, especially with LA and Oakland, in this concept of bargaining for the common good. that our contracts aren't just about us, that if our children aren't housed well, if our children don't have the things they need for a good and successful life, we can't do our jobs and our city can't thrive. So we were ridiculed by our mayor and by others in public office for having housing demands in our contract. But let's have some logic about this. If children cannot afford to live in our city, who in the heck are we going to teach?
Right. And ultimately, you know, I've talked to teachers who've shared stories that they've had students who are homeless, and that they'll, you know, how do you teach a kid that, you know, comes to school, you know, that didn't have breakfast or is living in really unstable and uncertain conditions, you know, in this kind of chaos? How do you deal with that without having some kind of demands to saying, hey, it's more than just about what happens in the classroom?
Exactly. By the Chicago Public Schools' own number, we have 17,000 homeless children in our system. I think your listeners can wrap their mind around that number. That's the size of a small town. It should be a national tragedy that there are 17,000 homeless children in Chicago. And so not as only is their housing insecure, but they come to schools with no social worker. They come to schools where most of our schools only have a nurse once a week. Imagine the health risk that a child who lives in a shelter has.
Yeah.
I can't even. I have taught for 33 years. I've taught homeless children. It is heartbreaking.
I don't know. I'll tell you, you know, I hear these stories that, you know, teachers have shared with me over the years, and I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you get up the next day and want to go back to it. I just don't.
Well, and then to be disrespected by not being offered a pay agreement that makes sense for what it takes to live in Chicago. One of the other things that your listeners should know in supporting the Chicago teachers and standing in solidarity with us is that by city ordinance, city workers have to live in Chicago.
Right.
So, for instance, I teach on the lakefront in a very well-to-do neighborhood. I can't afford a house where I teach. And so there's this, the haves and have-nots split has become worse and worse in Chicago. And it's not a place where there's affordable housing. In many of the places in the city, with a middle class salary,
right? So what's the demand then? I mean, you know, if there's a some verbiage in your contract about housing, is it a stipend? Is it building additional housing? You know, what's the request then?
It's building additional housing mainly, and also some financing relief. Other people inside of the city, other unions, do have some provisions in their contract, and we are asking for those to be the same. And around the housing, we're asking for school community reps to support our homeless children in our schools. And so it goes both ways. We're asking for help for our students, but we're also asking for home purchase assistance programs for our members.
So, I mean, you know, you look at the fact that, you know, every article I read shows, you know, enormous community support for what you're doing. And look, just like the GM strike, I think there was enormous community support because I think the view is it's not about the individual. It's about much more than just how many coins you're putting in your pocket.
You know, it's interesting to be a teacher leader. When they started in the 2012 strike, I was also one of our leaders in the union. And the narrative was teachers are just greedy. And they kept hammering that teachers just want more money, right. We're greedy. And that isn't working this time. So the narrative they've been trying to spin on us is that we want too much, that it's ridiculous to ask for these things in our contract. And actually, they are losing this spin. We're telling the truth about what it feels like to be a child living in this city and how difficult it is for our working class families to prosper here. And since that's the lived experience of most Chicagoans, they believe us.
Yeah. And look, I think every parent, you know, wants the best school, that the best opportunity in education, the best school in their neighborhood that they can possibly get. And when you tell stories that, you know, there's a nurse once a week, there's a librarian occasionally, you don't have counselors, you don't have resources, you know, you don't have resources. I mean, I talked to the one teacher in Oklahoma who said, you know, I get there a month early so I can find chairs that all have feet on them so that they don't wobble, because that's a major distraction. When that's the bar, you know, I think people start to pay attention and say, look, you know, it's got to be better than this.
Exactly. And part of what's happened in our city and urban districts around the country is obliterating and starving the neighborhood school, putting in these shiny, brand new charter schools, the public dollar. And purposefully letting our public schools go to pieces. You know, another thing, interesting thing for your listeners, because they're so well aware of labor issues throughout the country, is that we are not striking on our own. We are also striking with SEIU 73 here in Chicago. And that is the union that represents many of our support staff, our bus drivers, security guards, janitors, and some of our special education assistants, teaching assistants. And we are going out on strike together. And that is the first time since the Chicago schools was successful in dividing us up as union members and as workers. We do not have a floor-to-ceiling Chicago Teachers Union representation in our buildings. They peeled away workers,
right,
one group at a time from us. And so this is historic in that we are going on strike together, closing the buildings fully down. And also, this means that we are working as hard as we can for our lowest paid earners inside our district.
Right. Now, did they privatize all of those jobs? I look at my local school district here. You know, the substitutes were privatized. The lunch lady was privatized. The janitors have been privatized. So they're all separate, you know, third-party administrators of all of this stuff. Did they do that to you guys in Chicago, or are they still considered public school employees?
Some of them are public school employees. They are allowed to join SEIU and be union employees, but they are being regulated and governed by private institutions. We have Aramark and Sodexo that are doing our cleaning services.
Yep.
And I can tell you personally, my school's just filthy.
No, I mean, that's what you get. I mean, because, you know, the old janitors, the old cleaning people, they actually took pride in it because they were paid a reasonable wage with some decent benefits. The new folks, you know, and it's the same thing that I know. They're paid a poverty wage with virtually no benefits.
Well, actually, our custodian what has been a long time CPS custodian, and he's been humiliated by these conditions. It breaks his heart every day to not leave our school in pristine condition. It is soul-sucking to be given 4 hours to do what needs to be done in eight. And this is such a difficult way for a worker to have to live, because he's learned the hard way to just go home.
Right.
You know, there is not going to be any personal benefit for or possibility of finishing the work in the amount of time given or with the equipment given.
So, I mean, in looking at this, I mean, the people who are at the top of this, do they see this, or is it a situation where it's all about the pennies, it's all about the bean counters, or is it just, look, you know, we don't really care. It's about, you know, following the Broad manual and starving public education to the point to where it all becomes charterized and all becomes privatized.
Well, we always have to look at who's at the top of this, don't we? And in Chicago, we don't have an elected school board. We are the only system in Illinois that has a school board that is appointed by the mayor. So really, we are not striking our district or our bosses. In essence, we are striking our mayor. And our mayor's only been in office for 5 months. If you looked at her platform that she ran on and won on, it can be just copy and pasted from the Chicago Teachers Union platform.
Right.
Yet she has what I consider it as a worker, as a rank and file worker, it feels like she's gone to war with us. I mean, going toe to toe with us for things that when she wanted to be elected, she promised, like smaller class sizes, support services for kids, more money from TIF funds and from the state going directly to the classes, not being spent on administrative fees or privatization. I'm on our bargaining team. I sit there at the table hour after hour, and there is no evidence that she is willing to put her campaign demands in writing.
So let me ask you, kind of the last line of questioning, because, you know, something has to be done. Obviously, you guys are taking, the last step. I mean, to me, and maybe you'll disagree, but going on strike is the last arrow in the quiver, so to speak. How do we help? What do people do?
Oh, thank you. And I think that we feel the solidarity around the country. I have to give a shout out to Randy Weingarten, the president of AFT. She just had a national call with us with 62,000 teachers on it. The pressure from outside absolutely does work because the world is watching the Chicago teachers. I think watching our union, we are expected to be the ones that fight for what's right for kids. And we're at this critical juncture. Before, what we were experiencing was incredible austerity, that they had cut our schools to the bone. So our 2012 strike, where monumental, was about clawing with our fingernails to keep what we already had. There is money now. They're just not putting it in the right place.
Right.
So the acts of solidarity are understanding what's going on, supporting what's going on, and social media, I believe we are winning the social media space. And speaking knowledgeably and letting people know what's going on is a huge support to us.
Yeah, and I loved your hamster with your hamster's picket sign on.
Sure, let me tell your listeners what that's about. My teaching colleague put a picket sign on her hamster saying that he was wanting a fair contract now, and our tagline has been, class pets don't cross picket lines. So one of the things that strikes me in being involved in the strikes around the country, I think you know about UCOR, the United Caucuses of Rank and File Educators. Many of us, through this work, have connected with one another. And in every single instance, to me, the people at the top, as you call it, and the bosses, they disregard how clever and passionate teachers are. And we are winning the meme war, as we say. Our teachers know how to communicate so succinctly and so strongly that that is one of the reasons when they had the Chicago Sun-Times poll came out that the public is majority on our side.
Well, ultimately, you have direct contact with all of the parents and all of the students for years and years, so they know you. I mean, and I look back to that strike in 2012 as kind of a turning point in the labor movement where people started to go, maybe strikes are possible. Without you in 2012, I don't know that, West Virginia happens or Oklahoma or Arizona or any of the strikes that we saw last year and the year before. I don't know that any of that happens.
Well, we were happy to carry that mantle, and now it's come back around. We are bolstered by the teachers in West Virginia. How brave were they, in a right-to-work state that went so completely for Trump, to go out for that long a time in solidarity? How can you not be inspired by that? And then look at those LA teachers.
Yeah.
And we, on the bargaining team Saturday, we did a study of the Boston teachers' contract and what they were able to get, and the LA teachers' contract and what they were able to get, in a way of putting together our demands to be similar, because they fought and they won, and we are fighting and we are going to win too.
That's what I want to hear. So tomorrow, first day of the strike, we will be watching, we will be supporting, we'll be tweeting and Facebooking and all that stuff, our support to you, and I hope folks will show that love to you guys.
Well, I thank you so much for clear and complete analysis of what it feels like to be in this point in time in the labor movement, Rick. You're just the best.
I appreciate it. I hope you'll come back real soon to keep us updated on what's going on.
You bet. Bye-bye now.
Thanks so much, Michelle. Michelle Gunderson, Chicago public school teacher. She's also on the one of the board of trustee folks there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1949. That was the day Americans awoke to fears the nationwide steel strike would spread rapidly to include key fabrication plants. 500,000 steel workers had joined 400,000 coal miners on strike the morning before. The miners resolved to defend their $100 a month pension, instituting what John L. Lewis called the No Day Work Week, emboldened the steel workers to walk out of the mills. Within 24 hours, 96% of all steel production in the country was completely shut down. United Steelworker contracts were due to expire on the 15th, but the writing was on the wall. The mill owners decried anything close to mine pensions as nothing short of socialistic and refused to budge in negotiations. United Steelworkers President Phil Murray thundered that those companies that failed to agree to demands for non-contributory pensions and insurance would be shut down. But militants warned that President Truman's fact-finding board had already watered down strike demands. The president's board had been established to put off two previous strike deadlines. The guidelines it issued only encouraged steel magnates to stand tough against United Steelworker demands. These included a 30-cent raise plus increased company insurance and pension contributions. Now, it had become a defensive struggle over whether steelworkers would have to begin contributing to health and pension plans through wage cuts. By the time steelworkers ended their strike 42 days later, they had won the $100 a month pension minus what they would receive from Social Security, and they had to begin contributing to a health insurance plan with no wage increase at all. Still, workers celebrated that they had successfully defended the United Steelworkers against the all-out union-busting drive.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, interesting story coming out of Cleveland. Evidently, we've talked about the opioid lawsuits several times here on the program. It seems there could be a $50 billion settlement coming anytime now. Going to let the three big companies off the line. This AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health, and McKesson, they could all be off the hook, along with the manufacturers, Johnson & Johnson and this Teva. But you think about those three drug companies, 90% of the drugs in this country, three companies. So we'll see how this plays out. I don't think that's anywhere near enough. But we'll see, considering all the chaos that they have caused. Anyway, yesterday, the big Democratic debate in Central Ohio, down there, Columbus, at Otterbein College, as we've been talking about. Here to share some thoughts on the event, I've asked State Representative Tavia Galonsky to come talk with us. She was in the auditorium there at Otterbein College. Tavia, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me. Absolutely.
So give me the sense. I mean, this is exciting times. I mean, you know, what was it like being right there front and center?
It was straight out exciting. You know, first of all, CNN does such a great job of setting the whole environment up for you. You know, so really they transformed that sports complex. It's no longer a gym. It was just straight out. You looked like you were in a studio, but huge. And so I was right on the floor, just seven rows back. And then we got to go up and pose for pictures there by the stage. And I'm telling you, it was just nothing but pageantry. And seeing all of your favorite reporters from CNN just milling around and being in the audience, they were all so friendly and happy. It was a happy time. I think people were basically very upbeat about hearing the exchange, and it definitely delivered for me.
So you got a kick out of meeting the enemies of the state, I guess, huh?
Well, I like to think of them as the fourth estate, the people that, you know, look out for the rest of us. You know, while stories are being made, it's the reporters and the media, if they dig in enough and do their job, I think that they're going to serve to answer a lot of questions that we have on the national stage and certainly on the state level, too. So yeah. I appreciate them. I'm glad they were there.
No, we most certainly need investigative journalism, and we need more investment in it, obviously. So let's get to the big event. Do we have a favorite before we start into this?
Well, I'll tell you right now that I would gladly have any one of the people that were on the stage versus President Trump. So I'm going to wait to see itself play itself out. I'll be as supportive as I can to anybody who asks me. And otherwise, I'm literally just letting it play itself out. But as far as, you know, who did well, wow, Elizabeth Warren was great. I always think Cory Booker is excellent. I thought Senator Harris did just fine, although she didn't get as much airtime as you would have expected. But, folks did really well. And I don't mind telling you that before the event even started, you know, the Democrats were referring to this as debate week. So you kind of like watch to see who really cared about Ohio and who got out amongst the crowd and sort of mingled. And that, hands down, is Klobuchar. So I think she came ready for that debate. And she clearly is very interested in courting Ohio because, I mean, she was just all over the place. She was at a Young Dems event. She, you know, was at our state party dinner. And so, to me, that's really what I noticed is that she thinks that she can make a foothold in here in Ohio.
Now, it depends really on who has the best ground game in the state as well, who's building the best infrastructure. And being there on the ground, do you see someone doing a better job than others in being on the ground?
Well, you know, frankly, Bernie Sanders is not messing around. He has a great ground game. And basically, people have just been waiting for him to come back. So as far as the actual surrogates, people that I know, so they're completely spread out all over Ohio, I'd have to say Sanders is definitely not messing around as far as the ground game in Ohio. But then also, you know, I've been impressed with what Biden's been doing. And the new interest now I see from Klobuchar as far as ground game. And, of course, Tom Steyer is not keeping his money to himself, so he's got commercials running. I'm sure those are nationwide.
Yeah.
So he's doing what he can, probably more at like 50,000 feet. But,
ground game
is Bernie.
Oh, how I wish he would take that money and invest in senatorial races across the country and help win the Senate back. Because, you know, between you, me, and the four walls, there's no way he's going to be the nominee, no matter how much money he's got, no matter how many votes he's going to buy. It's just not going to happen. And it was just one of those moments where, you know, they're talking about billionaires and, you know, being able to get whatever they want. And I'm going, here's a guy who bought his way onto the stage.
There you go. And so, you know, yes, I'm happy for the democratic process, but I agree with you. When I think about the sums of money, you know, really, we should have whittled this down, in my opinion. We should have whittled this down well before now.
Yep.
And some folks need to very seriously consider staying in the Senate or going to the Senate. And I just really wish they could see that investment needs to be made there. And I'm just starting to worry that people aren't really focusing.
Yeah, because honestly, this race is, in my view, it's boiling down to just, you know, Sanders and Warren on one side and Biden really there in the center. I just don't see anybody else coming in and jumping up into the middle of that.
I don't either. And yet, really, what I am beginning to look at, and again, completely agree with you as far as the three on top. Now I'm actually looking at the remainder of the folks as far as vice presidential candidates. That's how I'm looking at them. So, you know, and because I've almost kind of written them off and wondering why they're still sort of there. But, you know, again, last night, they were all great. You know, they did a great job of saying what they wanted to say, putting out their issues, making themselves look like fighters. And, you know, Ohioans are going to be very impressed with that because, right. you know, we're a strong working class group here. Lots of people felt like they were the forgotten man or woman. And they like to see somebody out there fighting and mentioning issues that matter to Ohio, like the opiate crisis, like the, you know, the UAW workers. So, you know, I think people are going to be impressed by the show of moxie and spirit.
No, and since you brought that up, you know, the reality is, you know, 2016, I think those voters looked at Trump and said, Trump is that guy. I just don't think they saw Hillary as someone who was going to go to bat for them. You know, she her, on trade, she was not great. Granted, she was saddled with a lot of her husband's baggage with NAFTA, saddled with, you know, President Obama's baggage over Chorus, Colombia and Panama. And also, you know, that the TPP, which she called the gold standard. So a lot of people were soured on trade agreements. And Trump, you know, kind of jumped onto that space.
You're exactly right. And the thing that, you know, that I'm not proud of as far as Ohio is, we went from 5th to 22nd in the nation as far as education. And so believing in some of these short sound bites that Trump delivered, he really did speak directly to people who felt like, you know, the Democratic Party was moving toward elitism. They had forgotten about him, kind of written them off as for granted, right? Taking them for granted. And so I believe he was able to deliver, you know, an excellent message talking directly to those folks that I believe Secretary Clinton couldn't speak to. And so, you know, and we can sort of opine about whether or not some people, you know, had some other motives, whether it was misogyny or racism. But I think underneath it all in Ohioans, people were just probably thinking, just like Mr. Trump said, what have you got to lose? No. You know, why not go for this guy? You know, maybe things will be better in your life. And there's that nostalgia. I want to go back to the way things were when I was able to make a good living, two cars, mom could stay at home or work a part-time job, and the family was still together. So, you know, you really can't be mad at people for taking a chance on that.
Yeah, but I can't. I still can be. I still can be.
You're still mad about it.
Because it's one of those things where you go, you know, how do you trust a guy who's clearly got a past of screwing people over? And being, you know, just the ultimate con man, and how do you put that guy into the position of power? You know, maybe it's just I spent way too many years listening to him on Howard Stern and listening to some of the creepy things he said over the years. But, you know, it is what it was. And here we are. We're in this weird moment because, you know, I look at someone like you who comes from a very working class area, you know, Barberton, Ohio, outside of Akron, and, you know, the rubber capital of the world at one point, a major manufacturing area. That has been hit hard by deindustrialization and globalization. And, you know, solidly a working class Democratic kind of area that went for Trump. And then, you know, the next election around went for you.
Right. I won every precinct in Barberton. So when I'm visiting, when I'm getting to know the folks, when I'm engaging, you know, what I notice is they want to get to know you. It's hard to get into the group. But once they get to know you and you're theirs and they can see that you're working hard for them by delivering practical deliverables from the state, then that's it. They love you. And they count you as their own. They felt like they got that attention from Trump. You know, even though, again, it's not like he was actually visiting Barberton that I'm aware of, but still, they felt like he was closer and speaking more directly to them than Secretary Clinton.
Right.
And so when I'm going around, when I'm shaking hands, when I'm introducing myself, when I'm reminding them that I'm a former Teamster and my dad was UAW, my mother was an educator, she was in the union. So I come from a union family, the daughter of labor. They love that because they can relate to that. They know that the most important thing for me when I'm in Columbus is making sure that they keep their job. And anything where somebody's shutting something down again without an alternative, I fight against that for them, and they know that. And so, and you know, I never shut my door to them. If they want to talk to me, if they want to reach me, I've got my cell phone on my business card, and I'm going to put myself out there. So I never stand apart from them. I always just stand with them, and I think that they've really responded well to that. And it's a privilege to represent the 35th.
Yeah, you know, now on the trade issue, because, you know, it's one of the things that I've been saying that I think Democrats have been really bad on over the years. Did you hear anything while you were at the debate that made you go, you know, Democrats may be on the right side? Because, look, you know, full disclosure, I agree with Trump using tariffs. I just think he's boogered it up really badly. I agree that at some point we have to do something about China. We have to do something about the massive job losses that are going on. And while Andrew Yang was talking about automation and all that, which is costing some jobs, the bigger driver of job losses is outsourcing still. And how do we deal with that as a country to ensure that we protect the jobs we have here?
I agree completely, and you're right about trade, and I don't mind saying that I think the Democrats and the Republicans, or Trump, I should say, not the Republicans, but I think we have messed it up. Go all the way back to NAFTA. You know, Tom Sawyer represented this area, and they'll never forget that, you know, he voted for NAFTA, and people felt like it sure was a sucking sound. Look at all their jobs.
Yep.
So people here still remember all of that, and they're still really bitter about it. And so as they look out into the horizon to try to figure out why are these bad things happening to me, it is easy to see that, you know, they do feel sold out. They feel like their wages, you know, haven't increased. They feel like they don't have any, you know, job security, no job guarantee. All that's gone. And so, you know, they are able to say that they do believe the trade policies have made a difference. We've got some farmers in Ohio that are hurting right now. And I think that some of what the president tried to do, again, maybe long-term might be a good idea, but people can't actually feed their families on these long-term sort of ideas. They can't continue to hurt cycle after cycle like that and, you know, sort of still stand for him. So I think there are very serious concerns that because Mr. Trump has been erratic, I should say, and very sort of impulsive, then I think people are losing confidence that he's a great businessman and he can fix it. Now, I never believed that myself anyway. I never believed in him as a great businessman because I would listen to what was happening nationally and watching him, you know, go around from country to country as far as disclosing his interests. And the final thing for me was a person who won't show you your tax returns, show you their tax returns and wants to represent you, you should always be suspicious of that because what are your motivations? Why are you doing what you're doing? Are you really doing it for me? Or are you doing it for some other interest? That should have been a red flag to people.
No, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And look, at the end of the day, you know, the rumors of you know, him, one, being not as rich as he said he was. Two, we find out today, ProPublica has got a piece out saying that, you know, he inflated the, you know, the value of his property when he was looking for loans, and he deflated the property when he was ready to pay taxes. But again, this is stuff that all the wealthy try and get away with. And we've allowed him to do it. It's just one of those things. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Ohio State Representative Tavia Galonsky. She represents Ohio's 35th district. She was at the big event last night, the Democratic debate in Westerville, Ohio, at Otterbein College. So let me ask you, was there anything that you go, you know, because my response to last night's debate was, you know, this is kind of all stuff we've heard before. They're all kind of the same sound bites. You can only get so much in 75 seconds. I want more substantive debates because, you know, what I wanted early on is I thought the best path would have been kind of like a March Madness scenario where you had, you know, like 45 minute debate offs and you'd have, you could have brackets and you could bet on the brackets. I think it'd have been a great idea. But, you know, these little 2 minute, 75 second little snippets, you really can't get the breadth of someone's policy ideas in that bit of time. But was there anything last night that made you go, oh, I haven't heard that before?
Not one single thing, to be honest, because, you know, I like the way that I mean, you expect them to do this, do their homework on Ohio. So I like the way the different candidates would make these issues important to Ohioans. I appreciated that they had done their homework, but I guess maybe I've been so engaged in it that I didn't hear anything surprising at all. All of it seemed kind of the same to me, and I agree with you. The format lended itself to who could come out with a sound bite or something that would play the next day, and so that's not really substantive, and I agree with you that we would have been in a much better circumstance if we had more like a debate off. This wasn't a debate. This was a candidate showcasing, if you will.
Yeah.
And so, you know, without other information and digging deeper, you know, when they kept talking about it being debate week, I was hoping that the candidates would come and have sort of one-on-one sessions, you know, with a group of legislators here or there, and that we would be able to dig more into it. But they didn't really take advantage of that. I know that my different caucuses and organizations did reach out to them and offered them that opportunity, but maybe they felt like they had to do debate prep and they couldn't come and speak with us. But I think there would have been a lot of value in that, because we're the ones in our different areas of Ohio that really know. I mean, I do believe that, you know, as Ohio goes, so goes the rest of the nation. And so putting the actual candidates down in our areas and speaking to us, they could have traveled out more, you know, just to get to know what Ohio's like, because I think we do show something about the pulse of what's going on in the U.S. And it's not skewed towards, you know, rich people, but we do have some, you know, some people who live in Ohio who are wealthy. But we also have the other folks. One in four kids, you know, is food insecure. And so things like that, I think getting around Ohio and really visiting, I think would have been a benefit to them. And they didn't really do that, so we had to go back to the way that this debate, if you will, was set up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, having grown up in Cleveland, which is now the second poorest city that has the second highest poverty rate of anywhere in the country, you'd think, you know, though, that would be something that would have come up a little bit more, other than just being with Cory Booker. And I just thought it was interesting. And look, good on him for highlighting the issue.
Sure, and you know, let me just go back and amend my statement that I didn't see anything that surprised me. I look out for different groups that care about women's reproductive rights. So it did actually surprise me that Senator Harris spoke directly to that, because I had seen a note before from different women's groups to say that not one candidate had talked about that issue at all. And so, you know, good on her for bringing it up, and then for the moderator to mention that that was an important issue, that, you know, it would be discussed further. So kind of got lost in the weeds a little bit, but you're right. I did at least hear that, and I was surprised but happy that somebody did.
Now, I guess my response on the abortion issue, is there one Democrat on the stage who is against keeping Roe versus Wade? I mean, is there anyone? I mean, because to me, it seems like one of those issues you probably wouldn't even bring up, because everyone universally is on the same page.
Well, but see, I think what they would have been getting to had there been a more detailed discussion was actually that by making cuts, you know, to Medicaid, whether it's statewide, or certainly to our seniors, what you do is that impacts women and their overall health, you know, disproportionately, because if we can't count on, you know, everybody doesn't go to Planned Parenthood for an abortion. In fact, a lot of women go there for health care, but the way that all of that issue has been skewed has really left poor women in particular marginalized right out of all kinds of options, whether it's birth control all the way to screenings for health care. And that is really the issue that needs to get discussed, that people have made this around, you know, forced birth, but it's really more like your entire health care is in jeopardy if you don't have centers that are focused on women available. And that's the tragedy to me.
Yeah, and to highlight that, you know, one of the statistics I had read is like only 3% of what Planned Parenthood does is abortive care. So, I mean, there's 97% of everything else that you had just talked about.
Right. And as women, you know, 51% of Ohio, we know that. We actually know what Planned Parenthood does. We actually know, you know, that it's not easy to get our screenings, you know, based on, you know, whether you're staying at home, taking care of people. But when are you going to take the time off to get the necessary health screening? Well, you know, part of the way to do that is to have different health centers that focus on women's care. It is different from men. We care for ourselves, but usually we typically care for everybody else before we care for ourselves. So to highlight this kind of preventative care, we had the benefit of Planned Parenthood and other women's health clinics, and now with those closing, it shows you that women are not a priority. And so, you know, in my opinion, the candidates have to be speaking about this issue and making it front and center.
And I think they did a little bit of that. But, you know, again, we're going to have another debate and another, and I'm hoping the field whittles down either naturally through people not donating anymore or not getting into the polls. I'm hoping they narrow the field quickly so we can get down to a candidate and move forward. But Representative Galanski, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Take care.
Good stuff. Love to have you back again real soon. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Who's the big winner? I still say Sanders won because he showed really well. Came back from the heart attack, showed really well. Obviously, everyone's saying Elizabeth Warren, but you know, we'll see. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.